Yesterday, I was giving you a general outline of the foundations of the Zen feeling for naturalness in art and life by describing the fundamental principles of the Taoist philosophy and then of the Zen discipline itself. And we saw that the roots of the idea of spontaneous living make this conception, or rather it isn't so much a conception as a doing, something much more subtle than might ordinarily be imagined. A lot of people think that the spontaneous or completely natural life, as it's understood by these Far Eastern philosophers, is to act according to whim. There was, for example, a great Zen monk lived shortly after 1000 AD, who had a very peculiar way of painting. He had long hair, and he'd get very drunk on rice wine. Then he'd soak his hair in ink and slosh it all over the paper. Then he would do a Rorschach test on it and decide what kind of a landscape it actually was, and then put in the finishing touches. And suddenly, out of this apparent mess, a great landscape would be evoked. But the whole art of the thing lay in putting in the finishing touches. And also, there's a very curious thing. If a person who is untrained in painting makes a mess with a brush, it's liable to be just a mess. Whereas if a person who has the feeling of painting in them for a long time, and they make a mess with a brush or just do anything, it looks interesting. And that's why if you try to copy the best people in modern abstract, non-objective painting, you'll find it's a very difficult thing to do. Because there is more to spontaneity than caprice and disorder. And I want to try and explain what that is. I mean, wouldn't it be great if we could live absolutely on the spur of the moment? Not make any particular plans, not feel that... Well, you might make plans, because you can make plans spontaneously. But not to worry about whether you had made the right decision, whether you're being good or bad, selfish or unselfish, and not to hesitate in anything, you see? One of the great applications of Zen, as I pointed out, was to the art of fencing. And when you learn fencing, you see you have to learn to be spontaneous, because here of all places it is true that he who hesitates is lost. If you're engaged in combat, you see, and you stop to think what sort of a defense or attack you ought to make, the enemy's got you. So the way they teach people spontaneity in fencing is very interesting. When you start in to fencing school, you of course live with the teacher. He has a kind of ashram. But you're given a janitorial job. You clean up, you wash dishes, you put bedding away and things like that. But while you're going about your daily business, the master surprises you with a practice sword, which is made of four strips of bamboo, rather loosely tied together. And he hits you with this, surprisingly and suddenly, from nowhere. And you are expected to defend yourself with anything available, with the bedding, with the broom, with the pots and pans, just anything, defend. But the poor student never knows when the attack is coming, or what direction it's coming from, and he begins to get tense. And he begins to go around everywhere on the sort of alert, you see, watching which direction it's coming from. And as he goes down a certain passage, feeling that the master is probably lurking around that corner, and he's all set to go for him with that he gets that practice sword, he suddenly gets hit from behind. So eventually, he gives up. There's absolutely no way of preparing for the attack. And so he just wanders around feeling, well, if it hits, it's going to hit. It's all. And then he's ready to begin fencing. Because if you prepare for an attack from a specific direction, and it comes from some other direction, you have to withdraw from the direction in which you had expected it and send your energy in another direction, and that takes time. So what you do is, you go around with a mind of no expectation. That is called mushin, or munen. This is a very important Zen expression. Mushin, it almost means an empty mind. This mu, no. Didn't rub the ink long enough this morning. No shin. You could also call it no heart, because the character shin means both heart and mind, but it isn't quite the same as our word heartless, as we use it, and it isn't the same as the word mindless, as we use it, meaning stupid. To be in the state of mushin is to have a mind like a mirror. And of this, the Taoist sage Zhuangzi said, the perfect man employs his mind as a mirror. It grasps nothing, it refuses nothing, it receives but does not keep. And when anything comes in front of a mirror, it reflects it instantly. The mirror doesn't wait to reflect it. They also say, when the moon rises, all bodies of water instantly reflect the moon. I mean, they don't bother with physics about the speed of light or anything like that. That's irrelevant. Or they say, when you clap your hands, the sound issues immediately. It doesn't stop to consider whether it will issue. And so sparks from the flint, when it's struck, they issue instantly. But to do this, you can't try to be quick. See, if a Zen master corners you with a funny situation and he puts you in a quandary expecting spontaneous action from you, don't try to hurry. I know I've watched Suzuki wait a whole minute before answering, but he doesn't hesitate. He's not at all embarrassed by this wait. And he can answer with silence just as well as with a formal response. The point is, do something. When two young Americans wanted to study Zen, they were taken by a Japanese monk to interview the master and act as interpreter. And one of them had had some practice, you know, he knew a bit about it. And so after they'd had tea together and just discussed formalities, the master said in a very easy way, "Well, what do you gentlemen know about Zen?" And one of these students threw his fan, which he hadn't unfolded, the fan was still folded up, he threw it straight at the master's face. The master slightly moved to one side, and the fan went right through the paper wall. And the master laughed like a child. Huh? Oh, that's the sort of game they get in. Once a master was going around through the forest with a group of students, and he picked up a tree branch. You know, just as one might pick up a tree branch. And suddenly he turned to one of his students and said, "What is it?" And he hesitated, so he hit him with the branch. And so another student was there, and he turned to him quickly. He said, "What is it?" He said, "Give it to me. I want to see it. I'll tell you." So the master tossed the branch to him, and he took it and hit the master. Now, you may think all this is kind of rough stuff. But let me give you another story, which is on a rather different level. A certain Zen priest was having dinner at a big party, and the party was being served by a geisha girl who was so elegant and so skillful in serving that he suspected she might have had some Zen training. And so he decided to try her out. And he nodded to her, and she immediately came to his place and sat down in front of his little low table. See, everybody would be seated, probably, in front of low tables all around a room, and the geisha servants and people move up and down in the middle. And so she came down and sat down in front of him and bowed, and he said, "I would like to give you a present." And she said, "I would be most honored." Now, on the table, there are hibachi, which are little braziers with hot charcoal in. And you move the charcoal around with iron chopsticks. He took a piece of charcoal out in iron chopsticks and offered it to her. She had long, long sleeves on her kimono, and what she did was this. She wound them all around her hands and took the charcoal. Immediately got up and went to the kitchen, disposed of the charcoal, changed her robe, which had holes burned all the way through the sleeves, and came back. And she sat down in front of the master and bowed. And he said, and she said to him, "I would like to give you a present." He said, "I would be most honored." And so she picked up the iron chopsticks and handed him the charcoal. And he pulled out a cigarette and said, "That's just what I wanted," and lit the cigarette. Now, here's the lesson. The master's spontaneity and being ready for that situation was the kind of quick thinking that a good comedian has, who, in a completely unprepared way, can make all sorts of jokes and turn any situation into a jest of some kind. There are all sorts of people who do that. People who are experts in kind of like Dorothy Parker in that sort of repartee. But here it's been developed in a very fundamental way and to a very high degree. Now, the way in which it's developed, you see, requires a protected situation. Because if we all started to act on the spur of the moment, without the slightest consideration or deliberation, no. Go on. Come on, kitty. Shoot. Okay, you come with me now. And, oh, all right. if we all started to act on pure whim, everybody would think we were crazy. And people would avoid us and call the police and things like that. But what they do is this. They start you doing this in the context of a disciplined situation where there are very rigid rules for most of the time, but there are certain instances at which all those rules go hang. And you're in a community which understands the game. Because the point is this. When you start acting spontaneously, you're not used to doing it, and therefore your responses are unintelligent and inappropriate. But when you become used to doing this, and when it becomes second nature to you to act in the state of mushin, of no mind or no deliberation, then your behavior has matured. And you find that you're accustomed to respond quite appropriately, as the Zen master did in lighting his cigarette from the charcoal. So also in learning the art of swordsmanship, when he has given up defending himself, and... okay, kitty. when he's given up defending himself, and... preparing his mind for attack, then he's got a mirror mind. This is also likened to a vessel of water, like a wooden barrel. When you make a hole in the barrel, the water instantly flows out of the hole, because the water is always available to come out. It doesn't have to choose. And so you could also say that mushin is what Krishnamurti calls choicelessness. And because you see, choice in this sense is not quite the same thing as decision. Choice means dithering. You know, there are some people who, before they start to write something down, they wiggle their pens a little. The pen dithers over the paper, and then they start to write. And so in the same way, a lot of people constantly in the life situation, they dither, because that dithering is anxiety. To be or not to be, that is the question. Well, there is no question about to be or not to be. See, because to be and not to be go together, as we saw, they arise mutually. And Kitty, I don't think you're feeling very comfortable. Would you like to see if you could take care of it? I don't want her to get mixed up in the tape recorder. So then, in the situation of the Zen community, safeguards are set up within which you can learn how to act without deliberation, which is, you see, in a sense, going back to the state of innocence. Now, it doesn't mean that you give up thinking. It doesn't mean that you become an anti-intellectual. You all can also learn, and this is part of the later phases of Zen training, how to think spontaneously, how to deliberate spontaneously. The saying is, you see, stand or walk as you will, but whatever you do, don't wobble. So this is our difficulty, because the human mind is a feedback system. Feedback has a peculiar susceptibility to nervousness. There was a young man who said, though, it seems that I know that I know. What I would like to see is the eye that knows me when I know that I know that I know. You see? Now, in this way, we think about thinking. We worry about worrying. And then when that really gets bad, you worry because you worry about worrying. Now, that is analogous exactly to the kinds of vibration that are set up in certain mechanical systems. For example, if you I did this trick on television once. I had the cameraman turn the camera on the monitor. The monitor is the television set in the studio where you see what you are doing. And so on this show, I said, now I'm going to show you a picture of anxiety. Don't worry about your sets. There's not going to be anything wrong with your set, so don't turn it off. Now, I said, Mr. Cameraman, will you please turn the camera on the monitor? He does that. Now, what does he do? He's taking a picture of taking a picture, all in the same system. And as you do that, the system starts going like that. You see, it makes a sense up a kind of oscillation. And you see on the screen all these jagged lines dancing across. Now that's what's meant, you see, by hesitation, attachment, blocking, all that kind of thing which the Zen discipline is designed to overcome. And because the human being is such a peculiarly beautifully organized nervous system and has this tremendously subtle cortex, which is capable of all kinds of thinking about thinking, You can turn yourself on in the most extraordinary ways by, for example, getting earphones which repeat what you say just a fraction of a second after you say it back to you. They delay it. And you can get an oscilloscope tied up with your own heartbeats and get feedback through in this way so that you suddenly begin to see yourself behaving. And it completely balls you up because you wait for yourself to go on. But then you realize it's you doing it. But you can't wait on your heartbeat. You can't wait on what you say. And you get this sensation of going faster and faster and faster and faster until you just have to close the whole thing off. You'll go crazy. So that's what we're doing. And our civilization and our social institutions reflect this in hundreds of ways. And this would be true of any civilization, because all civilization is based on the development of consciousness and feedback, that is to say, the property of self-control, of being self-conscious, looking at what you've done, and then being able to criticize it and correct it. But who criticizes? Is the critic reliable? When you criticize yourself, who will criticize the critic? You see? Or to put it in the other way, quis custodiae ipsos custodies? Who will guard the guards themselves? Who will take care of the policemen? Who will govern the president? And that is the big problem. And when we get tied up in that problem, the Chinese got tied up in it because they were simply a very high order of civilization. So did the Japanese. There has to be a break. Somebody has to start throwing things. Otherwise, everybody will go insane. So, Zen functions in that culture as a way of liberation from the tangle of being too civilized. Now, you see, in Japanese culture, people are tremendously concerned with propriety, with good manners, and with keeping up with the Joneses. One of the funniest things in the world is to watch Japanese people having a bowing contest. It's a very frequent thing when friends meet or take leave. They go, and they bow, and they bow, and they respond, and it goes back and forth, and see who gets the last one in, because I'm more polite than you. And the worries about when somebody comes, you know, you visit a family, you always bring a gift. And they start worrying, is this gift suitable? What is it, anything as good as the gift they last gave us? And is it right for the occasion? Have we thought about it enough? Is there some symbolism in this gift that connects with this person's name or their birthday or something like that? And they think about these things interminably. And thus they cultivate in the ordinary culture has a great deal of social nervousness in it. People giggle. You often see girls who giggle and cover their mouths to say, I'm not really giggling. All sorts of funny things happen because of this immense social awareness and nervousness. Now, Zen breaks that up. Only it does it in a way that has high artistry to it. So you see, let's just take the aesthetic domain for the moment. And you remember I was discussing yesterday one tea bowl. And you remember too that in the whole history of ceramics, the Chinese developed some of the most elegant work imaginable. You are probably aware, I don't see a specimen, of the great work of the Sung and Korean potters. Very often done in a jade-like green, the most gorgeous texture. It looked practically as if it was carved out of jade. Well, that led on, you see, to the high techniques of the Ming Dynasty, with translucent porcelain, white clay, the most subtle designs of all. And that style went also to Japan. And the very, very rich people you read about in, say, books like The Tale of Genji, and you see in a film, and you must see it, Chushingura, the story of the 47 Ronin. The lovely things they had around their houses were unbelievable. The lacquer, the, the boxes in pure gold, and it was delicious stuff. But then, it was just like having too much eclairs and ice cream and filet mignon and cooked à la carême, you know, that French cook who made everything look like an oriental palace. And now what happened? The people who practiced Zen suddenly got an eye for the beauty of the ordinary. There were two reasons for this. One was that they became fascinated with what happened spontaneously, what pattern a brush would make when handled roughly and the hairlines were shown. They also, because they practiced Zazen, which is sitting quietly, not thinking of anything special, but having a completely open mind, that puts you into a state where you get much better eyes and ears than you ordinarily have. And you start really seeing things. So you know that famous haiku poem, "The old pond, a frog jumps in, plop." In Japanese, that plop is mizu no oto, sound of the water. And there's another poem just like it. "In the dark forest, a berry drops, the sound of the water." Somebody suddenly realized, you see, just the sound of the water is marvelous. That's all. Or they found that they kept getting in very, very cheap Korean rice bowls. The poorest, cheapest kind for peasants to eat out of. And suddenly it struck one of these Zen masters that that was an incomparably beautiful object. Nobody had seen this before. They also had the simplest wooden ladles, bamboo, and then a stick in it, for use in the kitchen. And one day somebody noticed that this ordinary everyday kitchen utensil was just lovely. And so in the same way they found that it was quite as satisfactory to listen to the kettle boiling as to listen to an elaborate concert. So what did they do? They started, through particularly a man called Senno Rikyu, to give parties for very small, few guests in shacks, little huts in the garden, made of very primitive materials, such as mud walls, and where they would go and sit, and out of the simplest utensils, carefully chosen by a superb artist, they would simply sit and enjoy the uncomplicated life. And so was born the tea ceremony. Now look at that, you see, in the historical context, that's terribly important. It was a going back to the primitive after people were sick of too much civilization. And yet, it was going on to the primitive rather than back. Because the people who selected all those things, they knew the whole tradition of their civilization, their culture. They weren't barbarians. Once upon a time, then you see, when this became the rage, Rikyu became attached to the court. The shogun had tea with Rikyu. And everybody started digging tea ceremony. And in due course, the whole thing became awful. Because what's happened today is this. Tea ceremony is essentially something to enjoy. And there are a few men left who know how to serve tea ceremony. And it's an extremely congenial, quiet get-together. With easy conversation, simple and unostentatious manners, and really lovely things to look at. I was present at a tea ceremony celebrated by a Zen monk who happens to be an American. And he is a man who has done a lot of mountaineering. And he has, therefore, with him at all times, the sort of equipment that you take on camping in the mountains, because he does a lot of climbing in Japan. And I said to him, won't you, this afternoon would be very nice to have the tea ceremony, and you did it once before here, and it was so pleasant. Would you serve it again? He said, yes, by all means. Before, he had served tea ceremony in the style that Zen monks do it, which is rather simple and direct and much more comfortable than all these well-educated ladies who are on tittering about it and are on tiptoe and nervous and hoping they won't make a mistake and all that kind of thing. It's just dreadful. So he suddenly came in with a small Primus stove, set that down. Then he had an old paint pot, which had inside it an aluminum mug. He set that down. He then proceeded to take the aluminum mug out, pour water into the paint pot, and set that on the Primus stove, but he ritually pumped up the Primus stove. He did everything in the style of tea ceremony, but this was a dirty old Primus stove. And suddenly the thing began to flame like the god Fudo. And he mixed the tea in the traditional way with the whisk, had all the perfect, lovely manners, handing us the aluminum cup. And we got into a long, it's a custom after the tea ceremony, after you've drunk, to pass all the utensils round for inspection. And this is exactly what happened. And we found that the aluminum cup had the year 1945 stamped on it for some reason. And we got into a discussion about styles of aluminum cups made in 1945. And it was the funniest thing, but it was a complete makeover of the tea ceremony into the modern idiom. Of course, the tea drunk in tea ceremony is that powdered green tea, which you don't steep like you make ordinary tea. You whisk it, and mixed with a small amount of hot water, into a froth. And it's called liquid jade. And it's a bit of an acquired taste for most Westerners. It tastes a little bit like a mixture of mate tea and Guinness. But when you get to know it, it's very invigorating and very awakening. And if you make up a strong mixture of it, it's a good thing to use if you want to stay awake all night and do work. And so you see, it's the legend was that Zen monks started this interest in tea because they needed it to stay awake during their practice of meditation. And it said that Bodhidharma, whom I drew for you yesterday, and he's always drawn with eyes that are wide open. Why? Because he hasn't got any eyelids. Once when he was meditating, he fell asleep. And he was furious and cut his eyelids off. And as they dropped on the ground, up came the first tea plants. That's why they have leaves shaped like eyelids. And are to be drunk ever thereafter for staying awake. So the plant of Buddhism, tea is the Buddhist drink, just like wine is the Christian drink, coffee is the Islamic drink, and milk the Hindu drink. Every religion has its drink. So then around this kind of appreciation, born of stillness and the delight in seeing how nature takes its course, came the entire cult of Zen art with its special kind of primitivity, its special ceramics, its special calligraphic styles, and its special gardens, which are the controlled accident. Now you see, as I showed you yesterday on that other tea bowl, this is a water jar. And they like to leave the bottom unglazed. You can really see that it's clay that way. But look, you see how the glaze has been allowed to run. It's what we would call not neat at all. And you watch somebody make one of these. And I have watched a man just pick up the plate, and as he applies the design of the glaze, he just goes whoosh with a brush and lets it drop on, and it's done. There's another man who glazes by wood smoke, and in his kiln he may put about 1,100 pieces, and he wraps them in straw. And wherever the straw touches, it leaves a splash of orange color against a purple background. Now, you see, the straw arranges itself according to the nature of straw. It doesn't follow strict human direction. And the fascination is when they open up that kiln and bring the things out, they look eagerly to see, what has the straw done? So, this principle of letting glaze run to see what will happen is Wu Wei. This is non-interference. This is Mu Xin also. No purpose, or it can also be translated, no specific intent. And now, of course, you see, sometimes this doesn't work. And the master picks it up and says, that's not very interesting, and rejects it. What are the canons of taste which decide whether he will accept one of these accidents or reject it? Because here an additional principle of control enters. See, say in the practice of calligraphy, a man may sit down with a huge pile of paper in front of him and do piece after piece after piece, and if it isn't just right, he throws it away. So he eventually makes a selection that comes out. There's a famous story of a Zen master who was doing calligraphy, and he had a very smart monk standing beside him who was his assistant. And the monk said, to each one as he did it, you can do better than that. Oh, no, no, come now. You know much better than that. This master got more and more furious, but the monk had to go out to the benjo, to the toilet for the moment. And he thought, quick, while he's away, he did it. And the monk came back and looked at me and he said, a masterpiece. So there's this element of selection, you see. Now, what determines this? How do you know? Or another example of this, there was a tea caddy, porcelain tea caddy, not porcelain, but clay. And when Senno Rikyu was having tea ceremony, he saw this tea caddy and made no comment on it. And the owner was so disappointed that he smashed it. But one of his friends picked the broken pieces out of the trash can and took them to a mender. He said, look, mend this with gold. And he put, therefore, gold cement and put this caddy back together, and so it had all over its surface spidery lines of gold. And when Rikyu saw that, he was just enchanted, and it became one of the most valuable tea caddies in the Japanese collections. spidery lines of gold following, just the apparently chance marks of a smash. There was a competition at the Art Institute in the University of Chicago, in which it was a sculpture class, and the competition was that each student was given a cubic foot of plaster of Paris. And they said, now do something with it. Well, the prize was won by a woman who looked at this cube and said, it has no character, it doesn't want to be anything. So she flung it on the floor and smashed it all up. I mean, she made dents in it and banged off the corners and put cracks in it and things. Then she looked at it again. She said, ah, now I know what it wants to be. And so she followed the grain in it, as it were, made by all these cracks, and produced this marvelous piece of sculpture. You have in this area a very ingenious sculptor by the name of Donald Hoard, who is a master at following the grain in wood and actually making the grain. The grain seems to suggest to him the muscles and the flow of the kind of body that he's making. Well, that's the thing. So when a master decides whether the accident came off, what he wants is this. He wants the thing to be the perfect harmony of man and nature, of order and randomness. Now, this is a curious thing in the human mind. When we play games, we get most fascination out of those games which satisfactorily combine skill and chance. Games like bridge, poker, have a sort of admirable combination of these two elements. And we can go on playing those games again and again and again, because you don't feel completely at the mercy of chance, as you do with dice, unless you cheat. And you don't feel completely at the mercy of skill, as you do with chess, or especially with a game like three-dimensional chess. So there's a sort of optimum middle where order and randomness go together. Well, that's what this man is looking for. He's looking for the optimal combination. You see, things that are artwork like Persian miniatures or the jewelry of Cellini and Chinese porcelain is too much skill, too much order. It's like those houses you go into where you daren't put an ash in the tray because everything is so clean and everything is so tidy, you daren't touch it. One prefers a house, you see, that looks a little lived in. It is more genial, more comfortable, somehow invites you to sit down and even put your feet on the table. Whereas on the other extreme, some kind of pad where everything is covered in dirt and filthy clothes are thrown in the corner and, you know, people are all paint all over them and so on. That's the other extreme. We don't want that. But that's that curious thing in the middle. Now, the most difficult thing is to hold to the middle. It's like walking a tightrope. And that's why the path of Buddhism is called the razor's edge. Because you see what happened. When all this kind of work in the course of history became fashionable, people began to affect these styles. For example, when Sesshu, the great master ink painter, worked, he would sometimes take a handful of straw and paint with that instead of a brush in order to get the sort of rough effect that he wanted. But later on there came people who could take an ordinary paintbrush and so exactly ink that brush that it would give precisely the messy effect that they had in mind. They would also be able to ink a brush in such a way, and this is terribly decadent, they could dab grapes on a vine and have dark ink where the shadow was supposed to be. And no ink at all where the highlight was supposed to be. That's when they started getting mixed up with Western ideas about shadows and perspective. They didn't have that earlier. But they were so skilled in the handling of ink that they would do this sort of thing, and they would imitate, you see, all the so-called rough natural effects of the great Zen artists. And so today in Japan, a younger generation of artists has decided it's time to break all that up. If we imagine, for example, haiku parties, the writing of haiku poetry. Basho, who was the great 17th century master of haiku, said, get a 3-foot child to write haiku, because they are the sort of direct, guileless things that children would say. But now there are magazines devoted to haiku poetry, where in every issue there will be 10,000 haikus written by people all over the country, and they get so stilted and so affected that one wished one had never heard of haiku. The same thing is starting over here. And you should see the entries we get in these haiku competitions that Japan Airlines and other people sponsor. But it all, after a while, becomes dated, stilted, and so somewhere again, the new thing has to break out, which is always coming up. But there's no formula, you see, for fixing it so that you can do it again and again and again, because the moment you start doing it again and again and again, it isn't it anymore. The real thing has escaped. Do you remember? Some time ago, there was a fashion for having wrought iron fish, just the outline of a fish. Some artist originally, you know, put this fish together and it looked great. But then you suddenly found them in every gift shop and dime store, and they looked perfectly terrible. So this is the mysterious thing. Well, not only in the arts, but in lifestyles, in everything, when you start saying, what is the technique for getting this thing? And people say, well, this is it. It's gone. Same in education. Same in music. The moment you start teaching something, what question are you asking? How could we, is there some method whereby in our schools we could produce from the music department every graduation ceremony 3 musicians of the stature of Bach or Mozart? Now, if we knew how to do that, that knowledge would prevent us from being surprised by the work of these people, because we would know how it's done. And when you know how something is done, it doesn't surprise you. That's why there's a Zen poem which says, if you ask where the flowers come from, even the god of spring doesn't know. Certainly the god of spring would be supposed to know where the flowers come from, but the truth of the matter is he doesn't. And so in the same way, if you ask the Lord God, how do you create the universe? He said, I have no special method. And this is known in Zen as a very difficult, this is the most difficult virtue to attain. So many of these things begin with mu. Buji. Buji. It means nothing special. It means no business, no artificiality. In American current, real cool. So Buji is where something doesn't stand out like a sore thumb. But it is absolutely different from being modest. A buji person may be immodest in the sense that if he knows he can do something well, he just says he can. He doesn't go at all sorts of blushing violet techniques. Buji, you see, is this mysterious quality of nothing special, no special method. Because if there is, let me repeat, if we do know the method and we know it infallibly, it ceases to be interesting. There are no surprises left. And the moment the element of surprise is gone, the zest of life is gone. That, you see, is why it's very difficult to teach Zen to yourself. Because you can't easily surprise yourself. The essence, you see, of this kind of spontaneity is response to a surprise. So the master, you don't know what he's going to do, and he surprises you. It's like trying to cure hiccups. Very difficult to cure yourself, because when you pat yourself on the back, you know when you're going to do it. So you're all ready for it. When somebody else comes up and slams you on the back, then that's a surprise, and what you needed was a surprise. Or it's like jokes. What makes you laugh about a joke is the element of surprise in it. That's why jokes aren't funny after they've been explained. So in the same way, all these Zen stories, if explained, have no effect. They're intended to produce what I would call metaphysical laughter. But this has to be a surprise. And so as to be surprised, well, there's no way of premeditating it. So you see, if you read, for example, there's a book out here called Zen by Eugen Herigel, who studied archery. Many of you have probably read this book. He had to learn to pull the bowstring in the manner of the Japanese archer and let it go, but not on purpose. He had to let it go without thinking first, I'll let it go, and then let go. He had to let it go, not on purpose. Now, that really bugged Herigel. How do you do something not on purpose? Especially if you're aiming at a target. Well, the whole point is, if you think before you shoot, it's too late. The target's moved. That's why we have a thing like beginner's luck. You see, if you simply point at something like that, if your finger was a gun, I would probably have hit the light switch. And so you get a person who's naive about a gun, will pick a gun up and bang, and the thing will drop dead. I'll never forget the first time I ever used a slingshot. This friend of mine was with me, and he was aiming away and not missing, and I just picked it up, and ping, and it hit. But I couldn't do it again. you get a certain naturalness there. So, there was a master by the name of Ikkyu, who was a great leg puller. And he had in front of his house a very gnarled pine tree. One of those things that contorted, and they love this kind of thing. And he put a notice up by it. It said, I, Ikkyu, will pay 100 yen, which was a fair amount of money in those days, to anyone who can see this tree straight. Well, soon, there was a whole crowd of people around that tree, lying on the ground and twisting their necks and looking at it from all sorts of angles. And there was absolutely no way of seeing the tree with a straight trunk. But Ikkyu had a friend who was a priest of another sect, and a smart boy went over to see this friend and said, what about this Mr. Ikkyu's tree? Oh, said the other priest, it's perfectly simple. He said, you go and tell him the answer to seeing the tree straight is to look straight at it. So this man went over to Ikkyu and said, I claim the reward. He said, you look straight at it. And Ikkyu looked at him in a funny way and said, he forked out the 100 yen and gave it to him. He said, I think you've been talking to Rosen down the street. Now, in that way, you see, just look straight at it. In other words, here's the bowstring, let go of it. Don't all this fimble-fambling, mimble-mambling, jumble-humble about the right technique of letting go of it. Let go of it, damn it. But that's very difficult. It's as if I would say to you, now, everybody, let's be unselfconscious. And so finally, in desperation, you at last learn to let go of the thing, which was what you were supposed to do all the time. And then one is as again as a child. This is original innocence. So this is the meaning of the person who was asked, what do you do here in this Zen institution? He said, we eat when hungry and we sleep when tired. Well, he said, that's being just like everybody else. They all do that. He said, they do not. When they eat, they don't eat. But they think of all sorts of extraneous matters. When they're tired, they don't sleep. They dream all kinds of dreams. So let's have an intermission. And then we can have discussion.